You're listening to Washington Post Live's First Look podcast with Jonathan Capehart.
Welcome to First Look, Washington Post Live's one-stop shop for news and analysis. I'm Jonathan Capehart, associate editor at The Washington Post. Last night was the big night, State of the Union night, President Biden's third. Here to help dissect what was said and the reaction to it, Leanne Caldwell, anchor at Washington Post Live and co-author of the Washington Post's Daily 202 newsletter. Leanne, welcome back to First Look.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
So you wrote in the paper yesterday that last night's State of the Union was President Biden's most important. How did he do?
Well, he really beat expectations, Jonathan. It was quite a strong speech, not only with its content, in the sense that he mixed this campaign vibe of a speech with a more traditional State of the Union. It was a speech that he talked about his opponent, quote, my predecessor is the term he used to describe the person who came before him and who is also running against him, Donald Trump, multiple times throughout. He was challenged by Republicans in the room, and he bantered with them and had quick, pithy responses. It was an extremely strong night for the president, and I think that the White House team is thrilled this morning.
Early in his speech, and I think this is one of the reasons why they're thrilled, the president made this point on abortion, an issue that's been front and center ever since the Dobbs decision. Listen.
Those bragging about overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women. But they found out when reproductive freedom was on the ballot, we won in 2022 and 2020, and we'll win again in 2024.
And when he was, and he had more to say on that, talking directly to the Supreme Court, the justices who were sitting there in front of them, was the White House's whole game plan was to not only show that the president's up to the job, but that the president's ready to fight for the job.
Yeah, that's such a great way to put it, Jonathan. Heading into the speech, there was a lot of concern. I wrote about this yesterday morning about the president's vitality, his vigor, his mental acuity. Not that Democrats have concerns about it, because every Democrat I talk to says that he is exceptionally strong mentally. Yes, he looks old, but they say that his mental capabilities are 100% there. But there is a perception among the American public, in large part due to conservative media and Donald Trump, who for years have been trying to sow the seeds that President Biden is too old for the job, that has seeped in to polling, that has seeped in to the public. And so what Joe Biden did last night, what the president did, was beat all expectations. He showed exactly that he is strong, he is on top of it, and he is in command. And on that issue of abortion, this is an issue that absolutely Democrats won on in 2022. It's an issue that Republicans have still failed to coalesce about any one policy around it. They try to avoid talking about it now that they know that it is politically challenging for them. And so the president went directly to the issues that he's strongest against Republicans and Donald Trump.
Last Saturday Night Live, its cold open was pretty much making fun of President Biden and, you know, his vim and vigor, having people on saying, you know, behind the scenes, he's sharp and he's with it. I think what we saw last night was that all that we've heard about what's happening behind the scenes is now out there for the public to see. Now, let's talk about the person over President Biden's left shoulder. That is the seat reserved for the Speaker of the House. Now, after having heard the speech, clearly it was written to make Republicans uncomfortable, to show the contradictions, and to make them squirm. No one exemplified that more than Speaker Johnson. Do you think the White House is happy with the way they visibly made him look uncomfortable throughout the speech?
Absolutely. Obviously, Speaker Johnson is very new to this job. He has never been in this position or even close to this position before. It was interesting because I watched the last year's State of the Union before this year's State of the Union, and watching Kevin McCarthy back there, he seemed so much more comfortable when his Republican conference was heckling the president. There was at one point he shook his head and said, no, no, no. But this year, Speaker Johnson had told his colleagues to be respectful and to behave themselves ahead of the speech. They didn't do that. And Speaker Johnson sat back. There was no admonishing from back there, but there was also no applause or clapping at very natural moments in the speech, something that Republican predecessors, including Kevin McCarthy, would do in the past. For example, you would think that when the president is talking about education or that talking about, you know, when he had the line that said, I'm going to bungle it a little bit, but we should always accept an election regardless of who wins. There's a moment that Speaker Johnson could have clapped or become involved in the conversation or in the speech, but he didn't. He sat there, looked quite uncomfortable, and it was he looks like he didn't know what to do half the time.
Yeah. You know, and I think the quote is, you can't love your country only when you win, is a line.
Thank you.
That he's used multiple times. The Republican response was delivered by Alabama Senator Katie Britt. Mm-hmm. Was she effective?
You know, let's preface that with, the response, the rebuttal to the State of the Union is perhaps the worst job in Washington other than being a Republican Speaker of the House. Either party that gives these rebuttals, it is very challenging. You don't have the energy of a crowd. You're in a room by yourself talking to a camera. The speech is written before you even hear what the president is going to say.
That's my biggest pet peeve. Go on.
So it's not even a rebuttal or a response. So with all of that, that it is nearly impossible to do a good job. Katie Britt, unfortunately, fell into the category of all the people who have come before her and not really delivering an effective message. And instead, and this is the problem, instead has become, you know, just a showcase for memes and kind of mocking. Senator Katie Britt is one of the rising stars in the Republican Party. She's extremely smart. She is pragmatic. She is friends with people across the aisle. She is one of the only senators who went to visit John Fetterman when he was in the hospital during his mental health crisis. So she has this is her second year in the Senate. So she has a long career ahead of her. But last night, she was not Katie Britt that most of her colleagues know.
In the 2 minutes that we have left, we got to talk about something that's not State of the Union related, and that is the surprising but not so surprising endorsement of Donald Trump by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Why did he do it? And did he ever consider withholding that endorsement?
Leader McConnell has said for at least over a year, maybe 2 years now, that he would always back whoever the Republican nominee is. He said that he hoped that there were choices, and he implied that he hoped that the nominee was not Donald Trump. But once it became clear, and after Nikki Haley dropped out of the race, McConnell handed out his endorsement. at probably the least important time of the Republican nomination process. And that was intentional. McConnell has not spoken to Donald Trump since December of 2020. He has not uttered his name since January 6th, but he still did endorse him. While his endorsement is probably not going to mean much, since it was not, it was done basically after the primary is over, it is still one of McConnell's last decisions regarding the former president, after making the very consequential decision not to convict Trump in his second impeachment trial. Because if he did and more senators joined him, then McConnell would not be in this situation of having to endorse someone he does not, who would prefer not be president of the United States.
Leanne Caldwell, co-author of the Washington Post Daily Too Early 202 newsletter. Oh, there's a cat back there. For a minute there, I thought it was just a pillow.
There. My cat loves to be on television.
Oh, man, it's like the pillow's moving. Leanne, have a good weekend. Thanks, as always, for coming back to First Look.
Thanks, Jonathan. You too.
Time for the Opinions Roundtable. So let's go to the opinion side of the Washington Post, where we'll find Washington Post columnists Hugh Hewitt. Are they here? Yes, Hugh Hewitt and Jason Willick. Hugh, Jason, welcome back to First Look.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jonathan. So,
before we get into State of the Union, let's talk about the breaking news that hit at 8:30. So about 45 minutes ago, the February jobs numbers, 275,000 jobs created, stronger than expected, 3.9% unemployment ticked up, but unemployment still remains under 4% for more than 2 years. Good news for the economy, right, Hugh?
No, Jonathan, I don't think it is, because the consumer confidence number went down in February, and I don't think those are the kind of stats that drive it back up. And until and unless inflation actually recedes back to the 2% or less level, Americans will continue to pay more for gasoline, groceries, and rent, and the economy doesn't feel good to them. So those numbers are good in the abstract. They might lift the market. They might be good for upper-income people. But they aren't going to change the basic economic stagflation that we've got right now.
Jason, would love your thoughts, especially since, I thought 3.9% unemployment for below 4% unemployment for this long stretch is good news.
Yeah, the big thing I'm watching is wage growth beating inflation. So it is right now. It's a little bit higher. About 1% higher than inflation. We had, for a couple of years, basically after COVID, inflation beating wage growth. We've now had, I think starting in about 2023, wage growth started to exceed inflation again, not enough to make up for the previous years of inflation going faster than wages. So I think that's what I'm looking at. I think that's the right direction. If people's wages are going farther, and we'll see if that continues in the coming months.
Okay, Hugh, this is sort of like, I'm just teeing it up. Your reaction to President Biden's State of the Union address last night?
Well, I have the advantage of age over both of you. I've watched between 40 and 50 of these things, and so I can assess them relative. It was the most disturbing State of the Union I've ever seen. And disturbing
for real,
is
Hugh?
A very... What's that?
For real?
For real. I'm 68 years old, so I've been watching these since being a freshman in college, and I'm addicted to them. Not only have I been a speechwriter for attorney generals and former presidents and a ghostwriter for them, I like the art and the form. I like the whole setting. I like the pageantry. I'm a geek when it comes to this stuff. And so Bill Clinton used to amaze me. He was good. President Obama would hit rhetoric that was wonderful. President Reagan was the best, although George W. Bush in 2002 with the Axis of Evil, State of the Union, was, I thought, uplifting, inspiring, and reviving. I thought this was disturbing. And there are 10,000 partisan takes out there. I think Leanne and I watched different speeches. But I know Democrats and people in the Beltway see different things. I've been in California for a couple of months than other people do. I was just disturbed by the mumble shout fest nature and very upset that he waited almost 45, 50 minutes to get to the hostages, Israel and Gaza, and spent less than 6 minutes of 68 minutes on the most important part of the world and the most important crisis facing us. The Ukraine opening was strong. I thought, oh, this is going to be good. This is going to be an appeal to come together on behalf of Ukraine, Israel, and the hostages. And it descended into a basically a re-election partisan shout fest mumbled that was often very badly delivered. So that's from the right. And from the left, you hear cheering. I know that.
Jason, was this, I mean, we are younger than Hugh, maybe.
A lot younger.
Significantly younger than Hugh, and you're younger than I am. But the most disturbing State of the Union, I mean, I remember the speech Speaker Pelosi ripped up as being one of the most disturbing State of the Union addresses I've ever heard. But your reaction to last night?
Look, I thought it was a much more of a campaign-style speech than we're used to in States of the Union. I think that was because the White House calculated that they're concerned about President Biden's standing probably with Democrats because of these, you know, this speech probably came at one of the lowest points in his presidency. His polling has been bad. There's been, you know, Trump has been getting stronger. There's been bad, you know, the Robert Hur report was bad for him, et cetera. I think that they were trying to buck up the Democratic base and give, you know, a kind of campaign speech, style speech, that would increase the confidence of Democrats in their president and their 2024 candidate. And I think it succeeded in that extent. You know, I'm also a center-right person, and you know, it didn't work for me. I thought, you know, I thought the appeal on Ukraine was not likely to get Speaker Johnson to actually be able to pass a compromise on Ukraine. I thought that it basically painted him into a corner and, you know, compared, you know, skeptics of the administration's policy with January 6th and so on. So, I thought it may be effective politically. I thought it was probably, it did politically what it was intended to do in terms of the Democrats. I'm not sure it was a particularly statesmanlike speech.
To your point about Ukraine, Punchbowl News reported a couple minutes before we went on air, they talked to Speaker Johnson. And he told them he is discouraging Republicans from signing a petition to bring legislation to the floor that would authorize aid to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan, and separately said he has given House chairs no assurances he will bring a foreign aid package to the floor. So with every State of the Union address, there is always the response to the State of the Union address by the party not in the majority, the party not in the White House. So, Hugh, your reaction to Senator Katie Britt of Alabama's rebuttal?
It was bad. It was really bad. Senator Britt is one of the few I do not know. I know her only by reputation as being very smart, very brilliant. But it was a bad choice of positioning, a bad choice of delivery. And it's never a winning situation. Governor Huckabee did a fine job last year, but it was bad, really bad. So bad, I don't want to talk about it. Just
I was going to say, you are never one short on words. But on this one, you can't even talk more, Hugh. What about the delivery was so?
We are in a dark time. And I said to my wife last night after this, did Bin Laden win? How did we end up here with an 81-year-old president and a 77-year-old challenger and a deeply, bitterly divided partisan Congress after 10-7 with Americans held hostage? What is going on? How did we end up here? And then Senator Britt delivers what is, of course, it's written beforehand. Your pet peeve is mine, too. Stand it's up so and bad. Talk about the speech. That these are professionals. They ought to be able to respond in real time and, you know, do a little 8-minute extemp and go home. Nobody watches it anyway. But my gosh, it was overly dramatic. I'll turn to Jason. I don't want to beat up on a senator I don't know and I haven't had the courtesy to speak with beforehand, but it was just bad.
Well, you know, Jason, on that point, you know, we got embargoed. It was released to the press, the prepared remarks. And I read them before the president even spoke. So I had places where I was looking to see if she was going to change, given what the president said. And thankfully, when it came to the young woman who was murdered in Georgia, she had a whole thing in there about the president didn't say her name and he should apologize. He wouldn't even apologize to her parents. Well, he did during the speech and did address the parents directly. But Jason, this is the one time that I can remember where Hugh and I are on the same page. Are you joining us?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I thought there was something off about the delivery. And so I agree with you. It didn't, it was in the kitchen and it was talking about very grave matters, and it was sort of over-delivered, I felt. Senator Britt sort of sounded like she was trying to overemphasize every word and emphasize the emotion in every word, and it was just a little bit too much.
I mean, the Oscars are this Sunday, so, you know, maybe she's trying to be a dark horse candidate for Best Actress. All right, let's talk about the other thing that happened this week. Donald Trump is now effectively, he is the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, with the former governor and former ambassador Nikki Haley dropping out of the race or suspending her campaign. But in each state, Donald Trump lost between 15% and 40% of the primary vote to Nikki Haley. Should Republicans worry about what that means for the general election, Hugh?
No, not really. I think that's fairly normal. I thought the most interesting data point of the entire primary season is the 20% uncommitted vote in Minnesota on the Democratic side. That is an alarm bell. I think the response that you got last night was in response to that alarm bell. The 20% represents not only the DFL, the old hard line left in Minnesota, but also the Somali American community that is deeply concentrated in the suburbs of St. Paul and in Somalitown there, like Little Kabul is outside of San Francisco, or Beverly Hills is home to a lot of Persian expats. The 20% uncommitted vote in Minnesota is much more significant than the 20% that Nikki Haley got, because a lot of Nikki Haley's votes were, let's face it, independents and Democrats who may or may not go this way. I think that we're in for the longest, roughest, nastiest presidential campaign of my lifetime. And there have been some long, rough, nasty ones before, but this one is going to be just a roller coaster, rock and roll, rock'em, sock'em, 9 months of misery.
Wow, Hugh, I mean, maybe I should go buy a lottery ticket, because I agree with you. This is the second time we are in agreement. So then, Jason, in suspending her campaign, Ambassador Haley did not endorse Donald Trump. She said that he had to earn her and her supporters' support. Can he do it?
That kind of reminds me of Paul Ryan in 2016, after Trump secured the nomination and the endorsement eventually came. I think that he probably can. I think that Nikki Haley wants to remain a player in Republican politics. And I think the party is going to unify around Donald Trump, as, you know, Mitch McConnell, of all people's endorsement shows.
Right. And so then, do you think Nikki Haley will follow in the footsteps of Leader McConnell and endorse Donald Trump?
Yes, I think she will eventually do that in the coming months. That's just a prediction. You know, I don't think she's in the running for vice president or anything anymore, but I think she's, you know, remains an active Republican politician, and it would be probably foolish for her career to do anything else.
Well, Hugh, I saw you nodding in agreement, so I'm going to move on to something Jason just mentioned, and that is the Veep stakes. Trump's senior advisor, Jason Miller, said this week that the list of potential vice presidential picks is getting longer. So, one, do you know who's on that list? And two, what qualities does Trump need most in a vice presidential pick?
Well, I have spent some time with senior Trump advisors on people who are being kicked around. Interesting. The most surprising name I've heard that the president, the former president, has thrown out is former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson, which I think would be a disaster as a vice presidential pick. So I don't endorse it, but I know it's out there. I personally want a veteran of military experience. I'd like to see Secretary Pompeo, Senator Cotton, Senator Joni Ernst. I would really like a generational age turn to someone of Jason's generation on the center right, and someone who can speak with clarity and contrast with the older, very old men at the top of the tickets and with Vice President Harris on the other side of the ticket. But I don't think we'll find out soon, because I'm also told very reliably the president enjoys this and enjoys being courted. The former president enjoys being courted. So I don't, maybe Jason might have heard something else, but those are my wish list, and they happen to be on the list, but the Ben Carson bit of news I thought I would share.
Wow, that's three yeah. things I agree with you on today, Hugh. This is incredible. But what you didn't say, Hugh, was who that Generation H person is.
Well, Cotton would do it. Mike Gallagher would have been fabulous, but Mike is getting out of politics to focus on his family for a while. And I salute him for the TikTok bill and everything that he's done. But he was on my short list too, but you can't leave politics and be the VP. But by generational, I think right now I would prefer Senator Cotton.
All right, Jason, I would love to get your thoughts. And get your, when you answer the question, get your thoughts on something that former senior Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway recently wrote. And she says that Trump needs a person of color on the ticket with him. If it's not Ben Carson, maybe it's Senator Tim Scott. Your thoughts on Donald Trump's VP potential pick?
So I've always thought that Elise Stefanik is the most likely. I mean, you know, they're both basically New Yorkers, but now Trump is a Floridian, so it's constitutional to have them both on the ticket. But, you know, Trump likes New York Republicans. He likes actually kind of moderate Republicans, as long as they're very loyal to him. I think, you know, Elise Stefanik's record is actually fairly moderate, but she, you know, makes up for that by being very MAGA and very, very pro-Trump. She's younger. She's a woman. He needs women voters. She's not going to scare people with her views on abortion and so forth. So I think that she remains a top contender. I remember last time the Trump people sort of poo-pooed the idea that they would take identity into account in choosing the vice president. Hard for me to see Tim Scott, honestly. But he was quite supplicating at the rally after New Hampshire. But I think Hugh's right. You know, Trump is enjoying the show, and he's going to make an intuitive pick, you know, in a short period of time when he decides to do it.
Should have mentioned Elise Stefanik, because she is on every list, especially after she took out two Ivy League college presidents with one hearing, something that's never been done before. And the impressive display of television talent and questioning talent was not lost on anyone in Trump world.
So then, Hugh, in the minute that we have left, you say she's on every list. Former Vice President Mike Pence served Trump loyally for 4 years and said that Trump, quote, endangered my family on January 6th. So the question is, why would anyone want to be Donald Trump's vice president?
Everyone says yes, Jonathan. And everyone wants to be the vice president because you are one heartbeat away from the presidency. You are the next logical candidate for your party's nomination. And then it will be a lame duck presidency from day one if Donald Trump is reelected. So everyone would say yes. No one would hesitate for a moment.
Wow. Even with the... Okay. Hugh Hewitt, Jason Willick, we got to go. Thank you both very much, as always, for coming to First Look. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks for listening. To always stay up to date with First Look, subscribe to Washington Post Live's First Look on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.